So we're in the period now, about the year 400, kind of late 300s, 400, heading towards the middle of the century, which will be our conclusion. And there's a good theologian called Theodore, and he's the bishop of Mopsuestia, which is in Cilicia, not far from Tarsus, where Paul was born, just so on the northwest, northeastern coast of the Mediterranean, not far from there. Now, he was trained in the school of Antioch, people who wanted to get criteria for judging hyperbole and imagination and metaphor so that it wouldn't just go floating off and make anything meaning out of anything. Now, he insisted, thank God, on the reality of Jesus' humanity, which, of course, all you've got to do is read the Gospels to do that. So he kept insisting on this. Jesus is one person, he said, and he used the word prosopon for person. But he has two natures, physis. So we better have a look at these two words that he used, because they'll become the words we use. Prosopon technically means face. That's what the word means. And it refers to Jesus as a subject who relates to God and to other people, and as his personality and his role. The word person is a very problem word, because we belong to an age that's very interested in person, and we've had Freud and Jung and everybody since, you know, looking at the whole. So we're well advanced in this whole area and very interested in individual persons, and that's got its dark side, the cult of personalities, which is kind of rubbish, really, basically. We've got all the dark side of it, but we've also got some good penetrating understanding of personal psychology, which they were much more group people. Anyhow, so the word person, when you think, don't translate it straight into your English head. Person means Jesus, the face that he had towards God and the world, the way he related. Physis, on the other hand, as I've said a few times, but I'll do it more thoroughly now, is a word from science. Kind of everybody knew what physis meant. Did they? We'll see an argument in a moment. It classified a being by what it does. Jesus did things that showed he was a man, because men, human beings, do those kind of things. So he's not a cow, he's not a tree, he's a human being. Right. He did things that showed that God was working in and through him. What he did was from God. So, nature, it shows there's something in Jesus that's from God, revealing God. So, okay. In Jesus, there were two different ways of being and acting, are united while remaining distinct. Don't ask me to explain it to you, but I'm just trying to get the words he was using to talk about this Jesus. Theodore was concerned that in Alexandrian theology, Jesus being man was in danger of being lost in his being God. A danger that Docetism first revealed in the second century, and by the way, a danger that I went through as a young man doing theology in the 50s, and you probably went through it as well. Yeah. So the danger was being God is so blinding in its light and in its centrality to our faith that all our questions were really not about how could he be God, but if he's God, how could he do this? How could he say this? How could he weep? How could he, you know, feel? How could he not know? And all the Christians, we started in the wrong place, in other words. Well, that was the danger that Theodore was aware of and trying to circumvent. In the West, the great theologian of the West was Augustine. And he used the word persona for prosopon, same idea. And persona, technically, was the mask worn by an actor to reveal the character of the play. I remember doing, well, I did honours drama at University of New South Wales at one stage of my long life, and there I became aware for the first time that the mask, I kind of had an assumption that a mask is something that hides, and that was just what was in my little head, and then I came to realise that, no, wait a minute, no. The mask was actually that which revealed, not hid. You've got to look at it. So in the great Greek dramas, if someone walked on stage, and it would be a male anyhow, whatever the character was, wearing the mask of Clytemnestra, you knew this was the wife of Agamemnon. Because the mask told you, you're right up the back of the theatre, but you, and you could hear the sound because it's so beautifully organised to do that, you don't need microphones, but you've got to know who the character is, and you know by the mask. The mask actually says who you are for the purposes of the play. Well, here, the persona was Jesus' person he's talking about, and that's what he used for that word, and he used natura for physis, obviously. Now we come to the Council of Ephesus, which is 431. Ephesus is halfway down the western coast of Turkey. Now this is a mess. Cyril of Alexandria, Saint Cyril of Alexandria, opened the Council of Ephesus before John, the Patriarch of Antioch, or the Roman legates, arrived. That's one way of getting your opinion kind of across. So they're still journeying. Maybe that, you know, it's not like modern travel. I mean, they may have been kept by monsoons and all that kind of thing. So he decided to get on with the council. So he opened it up, and Nestorius, who was the Patriarch of Constantinople, the emperor's see, refused to attend the council. It had been hijacked by Cyril of Alexandria. I read somewhere years ago, and I don't want to hold it against him, I don't want you to take it as a fact, but he was actually a millionaire at the time. He had a lot of rich, and I remember reading somebody where he bought votes, but at least, that's probably wrong, and he's a saint, so probably. Anyhow, Nestorius, the Patriarch of Constantinople, was condemned by the Alexandrians, that's Cyril, and the bishops of Asia. Bishops of Asia meaning Turkey, basically. Is this anti-Constantinople politics? Not unlikely. Now, when John of Antioch arrived, finally, and the boat beached and he arrived, he held a counter-synod down the road in the Josephite convent, which deposed Cyril of Alexandria. They just deposed him as a heretic. And when the Roman legates finally arrived, they sided with Cyril and they excommunicated John of Antioch. It's how these Christians love one another. This, thank God, the Pope, when he heard about it, how he heard about it I don't know, but he heard about it, he was unhappy with this and he insisted that Cyril and John be reconciled. So he got them to be reconciled. Like it or not. Now, Ephesus based its decision on Nicaea, the Council of Nicaea, and it achieved a dogmatic solution insisting on something that's still quite problematic unless well understood. This is where you get Mary called Theotokos, the bearer of God, the God-bearer, which is not actually a statement about Mary, it's a statement about Jesus being God. You get me? But the problem with that is it has to be kind of understood, obviously, in that world where you've got mother gods, you know, the great goddesses. So are we saying that Mary was the mother of God, you know? The simpler thing to say is Mary's the mother of Jesus, and Jesus is God. Okay, but anyhow, we're into this language from then. And there was a great celebration, and they had the basilica built to Mary, the mother of God, and that was the time when they built the first big basilica in Rome, which is now Maria Maggiore, you know, that was built to celebrate this great event, which was actually about Jesus, it's about Mary, but it's basically about Jesus. And it's a true statement, of course. We're still part of our faith, as long as we understand it. But it failed to open up a theological, speculative way towards solving the existing tensions between all the different groups in the East. And so it failed to achieve any real peace. Now, I've got for you, hard to read, but it's got some interest for me and maybe for you. And don't ask me why I went to all this trouble, but I did. These were the bishops present at the Council of Ephesus in 431 when they all arrived. The parts in red Can you see a bit of red there somewhere? They are the bishops who were with John of Antioch. The parts that are not in red, and there are actually more of them, if you counted them, were with Cyril of Alexandria. So it was quite a divided council. And what interests me in showing you the map, so here, basically, you can see Egypt is all with Cyril of Alexandria, Palestine and all this Syria area is basically with John of Antioch. Well, you'd expect that because they're all pals over here. Then you move here, most of these ones here, but look, a few isolated ones here, sided with John of Antioch. But on the whole, they're mostly, there's Ephesus there where they had the council. So there's a big bulk of that happening there. Carthage was also Rome. So there's a division. But what interests me in showing it to you, more than any of that, because that's hard to kind of access, is look at the number of bishops. And get your head around it. And stop fooling around. Having one bishop for Western New South Wales and running out of priests. For God's sake, the church would never have got started if it was that stupid. Yeah. I've got to say it, we are stupid. And until you revolt, we're going to continue to be stupid. We're going to have one parish in Belconnen in 5 years' time or something when a few people die, probably including me. And we're all going to say, isn't this wonderful? Now we've got one mass on Sunday instead of four, and we've got a priest kind of... cut it around to say Mass and shift it into the consecration and shift it out again. I mean, do you want a church like that? Well, if you don't want a church like that, well, you start insisting that the bishops ordain priests and stop sticking with a method that is clearly not working. Much as, well, I belong to a beautiful religious order, Mission of the Sacred Heart. I can't think of a finer life for any young man to lead. But no young man is listening, or hardly any. That doesn't mean it's what I'm saying is wrong. It means that somehow it's not touching their lives and they're not accessing it, you know? Mm-hmm. Well, we can go on forever doing this. Or we can say priesthood is about leadership, etc. Anyway, back to that thing. And we can start ordaining leaders, men, women, whoever's a leader, for God's sake. Anyhow, that's enough. I'm ending up with John of Antioch or someone here in a minute. But until you insist on it, it won't happen. You'll go like Tuggeranong. How big is Tuggeranong now? And then it's going to get bigger and bigger. Well, I don't care. Say it. I don't know if it's effective. Write a letter to the Archbishop and tell him, say this or whatever. What's effective is up to other people, because I'm being as insisting as I can, and of course I haven't got the decision, and that's probably good. Wiser people have the decisions. But if everybody's silent, if everybody just accepts it, if no one says anything, they'll all say, oh, well, you know, they won't do anything. That's how it works. I don't know how you do it, but do it our way. That's what I'm saying. You've put it so beautifully. Why aren't you giving the lecture? That's what. But please just have a look. No, we won't go any further. Please have a look at this, and look at these are just the bishops. Look at them, in this little tiny part of the world, and no doubt there were plenty of priests and deacons helping them, and so on. Some of them were. Some of them weren't. Eutyches, this will be of interest to you. Eutyches, in 448 AD, getting close to the end, a 90-year-old monk called Eutyches attached himself to Cyril of Alexandria's idea of having one phusis, one nature in Jesus. You might have heard of the Monophysite heresy, which of course... Chalcedon, which we're going to come to, wasn't accepted in Egypt. So the whole of Egypt, that's what happened with the Coptic Church, went into what in the West we called heresy, till 30 or 20 years ago, when Pope John II agreed that what they were saying was what we were saying, but using different words. So for how many years were they considered heresy? And they, because they meant something different by nature to what we meant by nature. So the argument was actually about words. And people didn't sit down till recent times to actually work out, what do you believe? What are you actually trying to say? They just are, anyhow. And we're still doing it, I bet. I guess I'm doing it here without realising. You know what I mean? We're easily to do this. Well, anyhow, here, in his way of insisting, what he wanted to say that was all that was human in Jesus was consumed by the Spirit somehow, that Jesus was one conscious subject. he's going to be declared to be a heretic, so I'm not teaching you now. It's one conscious subject. There does seem to be a mixture of the divine and human going on here, but that's what this 90-year-old monk held. Others judge that Eutyches, by denying the two physis, two nature formula, which had gradually was gaining and will come into our thing, was teaching that Jesus' human nature was absorbed into his divine nature. Well, he probably was trying to say there's only one subject here, not two subjects, a human one and a divine one that don't talk to each other. There's one reality, one person, and he's using the word physis probably for person, don't know. So the danger, they said, that he's denying the humanity of Jesus, which was typical, by the way, a danger inherent in the Alexandrian theology, as we've probably noticed as we've been going along. So theologians took sides without clearly defining what they intended by this word physis. What do you mean by it? In fact, they meant different things. Cyril meant something close to being, or even subject. He was wanting to preserve Jesus as the one being, the one subject. Cyril's opponents used physis to speak of a way of acting, and they distinguished between the divine action of the Word and the human action of Jesus. Each side accused the other of heresies, and Eutyches asked the Pope to intervene. It's one of the early interventions of the Pope in this whole area. In 449, it gets worse. A synod was held at Ephesus, led by Dioscorus of Alexandria. It supported the rebellious clergy, including Eutyches, against Flavian, the Patriarch of Constantinople. The synod was supported by the Emperor Theodosius. Pope Leo rejected the council, and he called it the Latrocinium, the Council of Robbers. So you've got all these bishops with their little opinion pushing things through, and when it got to the Pope, he said, that's stupid, that's not it, that's not what our teaching is, so he just cancelled it as a valid council. And in 450, the Emperor Theodosius, who'd supported the council, died. That left a bit of freedom for the Council of Chalcedon in 451, which is the end of our little journey. And Pope Leo wrote something for it, which was presented to the council. If you believe the person who taught me history, he didn't teach history, he read books out loud in the classroom. Anyhow, he's dead now, I can say De mortuus nihil nisi bonum, but he was a hopeless bloody teacher. Anyhow, he gave me the opportunity to read what I wanted to read under the desk, and that suited me. So, but according to him, what the Pope read out at the Council of Chalcedon was the big show, and everyone was, you know, thinking, because Pope, you know, and other people I've read from the East Church said it was just, was hardly relevant. So it depends on who you think's important, all that. Anyhow, this is what the Pope said. This is the great Pope Leo, who stood against the barbarians and went out of Rome and confronted Attila the Hun, isn't it? And all that. So, this is what he wrote. The same who, remaining in the form of God, was made man in the form of a servant. For each of the natures retains its proper character without defect. And as the form of God does not take away the form of a servant, so the form of a servant does not impair the form of God. For the self-same who is truly God, is truly man. There's no illusion in this union. While the lowliness of man and the loftiness of God meet together. For as God is not changed by the compassion exhibited, so man is not consumed by the dignity bestowed. For each form, morphe, metamorphosis, morphe, each form does the acts which belong to it in communion with the other, the Word performing what belongs to the Word and the flesh carrying out what belongs to the flesh. The first shines out in miracles, the second succumbs to injuries. That's what Pope Leo said. Personally, I don't find it all that helpful. You might, but that's what he actually said. The Council of Chalcedon, 451, makes very sad reading. Little attempt was made to seek understanding. This is my view of it, having read it, but you may form another view, but I don't think you would. I think I'm trying to give you what, as far as I know, everyone agrees. The declaration from Pope Leo provided a way through it, because it gave clear expression to the Western Church understanding of the reality of Jesus' humanity. That was the bit that kept getting lost, and the Pope insisted on the reality of the human nature of Jesus. The bishops finally agreed to the following statement, and here we are. The Council of Chalcedon. Speaking of the Son, our Lord Jesus Christ, that's who they're talking about, the Council asserts this, and this is a quote. He's perfect in divinity, perfect in humanity. True God, true man, of rational soul and body, for the soul, the psyche, is there. Of one being, homoousios, I've left an O out there, I beg your pardon, of one being with the Father in divinity, of one being with us in humanity. And if bells don't ring in your head, it means I've gone too fast and you haven't followed my logic. Have a look at that. The word homoousios is used in the one sentence ambiguously. Because in the first one, homoousios with the Father, it refers to one and the same being, because there's only one God. In the second use of homoousios, and they didn't pick it, or they didn't argue about it, in relation to us, it refers to one and the same species, ousia, not in the sense of individual being, but in the sense of abstract definition of species, because there's more than one human being. So he's not the same as us, meaning identical with us. He's different to me and different from you, but we all have the same ousia in the abstract sense of humanity. We share the same humanity. So here's one word used ambiguously in one sentence, straight up. Then the text continues, being in all things as we are without sin. And it refers to, the reference is to Hebrews 4:15. Hebrews 4 doesn't quite say that, not that that's a problem. It says, tested, peperasmanon, in all things as we are without sin. That's what the text actually says. The Council of Chalcedon goes to a more, like, using similar language, says, being in all things like us without sin. So it's actually a deeper, more ontological statement than you find in Hebrews, but clearly they're borrowing the imagery of the letter to the Hebrews. And it says, begotten of the Father before all time as to his divinity, begotten in recent times for us and for our salvation from the Virgin Mary, the Mother of God, as defined in the Council of Ephesus, as to his humanity. So that's part of the statement made at this council, which, by the way, brought peace, really. Basically, probably they were just tired of arguing about it, and they kind of... Then it goes on, continuing, we confess, we, the bishops present at the council, one and the same Christ, the Son, the Lord, the only begotten, made known in two natures. So they took sides in the debate, and by two natures they were siding with Antioch. Two phusis, a divine and human, they were actually deciding against Egypt. Who, because they had the word one phusis, and that's why you get a lot of people didn't accept the Council of Chalcedon. A lot of the bishops walked away and didn't vote for it, and the Egyptians walked away, and that's where the Monophysite, same word, one phusis, heresy, so-called, started and continued right on, right up till today, till we realise that it's not a heresy at all. They meant different things by the different words. Okay. Now, look at it again. Made known in two natures, obviously divine and human, this is very important, it's quite beautiful, without confusion, without change, without division, without separation. Let's unpack that. Without confusion. It was not, this is our faith, so think it through if you can. It's not a mixture of divinity and humanity. Like, Jesus isn't a mixed hybrid with a bit of this and a bit of that. Humanity is like ours, of course, but without sin. Not confused, not mixed in with the divinity. So it's really, you've got an apple orchard, and there are apple trees in the orchard, and Jesus is one of the apple trees in the orchard. You've got the species Homo sapiens, you've got you, and you've got me, and you've got Jesus, an individual of the human species, absolutely identical with us in his human nature, except that he never sinned, which is a marvellous thing. In other words, he lived humanity beautifully, truly, perfectly, humbly, without sin, whereas we muck up our humanity. Because when we sin, we actually act less. So, in other words, Jesus, Christ the Son, the Lord, has human consciousness, human decisions, human feelings, human emotions, human thoughts, human words, and human actions. And being God, whatever that, I mean, that has to be explored, doesn't interfere with that or compensate for it or cover it or rise above it. That's terribly important. Or Jesus is not the incarnation of God, he's just an apparent person but not really human at all. So it's no confusion of the two natures. Without change, they said. Jesus is not inhuman, he's not a human, he's not subhuman, he's not superhuman. His humanity is not more than, less than, or other than our humanity. If you don't believe that, you're not a Christian, so you better believe it. But a lot of people don't believe it and still call themselves Christian. So we've got to, this is not an easy journey, but it's very important. Or we're not redeemed if we don't believe this. Without division, both ways of acting coexist in one subject, in one object of understanding. Subject meaning from Jesus' point of view as the subject of his sentences, of his actions, of his decisions, of his thoughts, of his feelings, of his choices, of his whatever, and where they're looking at him and saying, who is he? And making statements about what we see and feel and touch and see and remember. Well, there's no division. And finally, without separation, the one who acts in a human way is the one who acts, that's what phusis means, in a divine way. I can't put it better than that, but I'll continue because I hope it clarifies as I go. The differences of the natures in no way removed by reason of the union, but the properties of each are preserved, coming together in one person, prosopon, and one hypostasis. That's part of the definition of the council. One person and one hypostasis. And I've just said, note the accommodation of differences in preferred terminology. In the acceptance of prosopon, persona, and hypostasis, substantia or subsistentia in Latin, as equivalent terms for that which identifies Jesus as not the Father and not the Spirit. You with me? So that which identifies him, you can use either word, they said, prosopon or hypostasis. We intend by these two words to mean the same thing. Now I ask you to ask yourself a question, which I'm asking myself. Granted, on the human nature of Jesus, I hope that's clear, and it should be clear, and it's terribly important. Now let's look at what we mean by divine nature for a minute. Granted, there's only one God. What does it mean to speak of divine nature? Because there's only one God. So what does nature mean as a word which we then hook onto the mysterious divinity? Clearly we have to be pretty humble here, but what are we meaning? Nature, as I've told you already, is a scientific classification according to behaviour. So you look at human beings, they all behave in certain ways, so that's a common factor of human behaviour. So we call it human nature, does this and does that, and that's what it is to be human. And trees, all these different orchards, they produce the same kind of apple, so you can work out what belongs to an apple tree as distinct from a quince or something like that. But there's only one God, so we've only got one place to look. How can we? What do we mean by God's nature? Another factor that occurs to me as I pursue this question, the higher we, this is, I believe, terrifically important, the higher we ascend the scale of being, from a rock to a human being, let's say, the less something is defined by its nature, the more free a being is, the more its behavior is defined by the choices it makes, not by its nature. If I could explore that with you just briefly. If you've got one piece of quartz, one piece of, let's say, marble, and you drop it and break it, and you're Michelangelo, you can probably find another piece of marble to replace it quite adequately. Because a marble is marble, and this is what marble does. I mean, there's slight differences, but you know what I mean. It's kind of replaceable. One glass tumbler in the kitchen gets broken by somebody carelessly, you buy another one and put it in there, and you're just as well off. Because what it is, its nature, is that's all actually you need to know about it. Because it hasn't made decisions and developed and hasn't got all those other things. When we come to a human being and someone says to me, oh, who's this Mary Theophanus or something? And someone says, oh, a human being. Oh, thanks. That's, you know, that's really helpful, really. That's it. Oh, now I know Mary Theophanus. I've got it all. That's good. Thanks. It's not enough. Because the nature is like it's real. I mean, we don't fly. It tells us a lot about us, but it doesn't tell you a terrific lot about us, because we've got the capacity to make decisions, to have decisions made about us too. We've got this because we've got this thing. The more free a being is, the more its behaviour is defined by its choices it's made. So to know you, I need to know you, this individual person who's got certain things in common with everyone else in the room, because we're all human beings, yes, and I'm not denying that or neglecting it, but heavens, there's a lot about you that that doesn't tell me. Whereas there's not a lot about a bit of quartz that that doesn't tell me. I hope the point's kind of obvious. Now, step further, God is total freedom. We can't get inside and pigeonhole God. So God is free. What do we mean by God's nature? God's nature means what God chooses to do. That's all it can mean. Because nature is a scientific term for looking at something by its behavior. So what does God choose to do is the only way that the word nature applied to God makes any sense to me anyhow, and I hope to you. We can know God only by knowing what God has chosen to do in relation to us, too. We can't get in and explore the divinity, for heaven's sake. And there's only one God anyhow, so we've got to watch for what God is actually doing to be able to talk about, in any meaningful sense, God's nature. God has chosen to express God's self in a perfect way in Jesus. That's our faith. That's what people experience in their religious experience. So one of the very faith statements we're talking about, but really profound. Jesus is the way to God. Jesus is the answer to our question. What is God's nature? You know? In other words, what is God's nature means, what does God do? Well, look at Jesus and we find out. God loves. God forgives. God embraces. God is universally caring. Oh, you run through the whole list yourself. That's what God is doing, because that's what nature means. I hope you're following me. It's so important. That's all you're finding out. But it's beautiful to find that out, because otherwise we've got all these ideas of God that are bunkum filling our little heads. What does God choose to do? How does God choose to relate to us is a question we want to know. What's the point of having that tree in your garden? It produces prunes, little plums that are very easy to put in bottles and kind of whatever it is and end up with, what do you call those things?
Prunes.
Prunes. There we are. Okay. And that's why we've got it in the garden, because that's what that tree does. Oh, great, good. Can I have a bit of something? Can you fix, can I get a bit of my gain in my garden, or whatever I'm asking. So we're asking, when we talk about divine nature, are we saying any more than, what has God chosen to do? What is the free decisions that this God, who isn't limited by belonging to a species, or belonging to some kind of like a bit of quartz or a human being, because only one, God, we can't ask any more than that. I can't in here. Now, faithful Christians in the first 4 centuries, which is what we've been following, our personal religious experience is confirmed and given meaning by our believing what has been handed down through tradition, especially the sacred scriptures. It may not give meaning to your life, but I think it must give some meaning, or I can't see what the heck you're doing here. And it must give some meaning to my life, or what on earth am I spending all my time talking about this stuff for? I'm not doing it for money. I'm not doing it for pleasure, though it is a pleasure to be. You know what I mean? It must be something to do with that. All of us are searching for meaning. And if you find something, you want to share it, don't you? With your kids and your grandkids and all that. So, tradition, there's something wonderful being handed down by hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and thousands of wise, lovely people, many of whom became saints. So by any standard of human criteria we're going to look at, someone who lives the Christian life, who believes in it and acts accordingly and makes decisions on it, they actually end up being very beautiful people. On the other hand, you can claim to do it and become the most pig-headed, narrow-minded pain in the whatever it is that the world's ever seen. So we're talking about reality here, not just words. But that's what's happened. So, we're taught to believe that Jesus is fully human like us. That's what the Council of Chalcedon insisted on, thank God. We're taught that Jesus is truly the Son of God, called that. From the beginning, Christians affirmed this in their words and in their lives, and they're trying to find out the meaning of it. The pressure to state clearly what people meant by what they said, because I'm a philosopher, I'm Justin, second century, I'm a philosopher. I've learnt Platonism, I've become a Pythagorean, I've become a Stoic, I've been all there, I'm searching for meaning, and I've been teaching in Rome, and I've come down to Alexandria, and I was born in Nablus, just north of Palestine, and I meet some Christians, and I think, gee, these are attractive people, they've got something, I don't know what it is, but it's making sense. What is it? I needed you, he needed you to be able to find words, and somebody must have found some pretty good words, because this great philosopher becomes a Christian. Because it made more sense to him than anything he'd read in any of his philosophical journals. Well, that's something. A whole lot of people came into Christianity because of the love and didn't have a thought in their heads, I suppose. But he did have a lot of thoughts in his head. And he ends up writing apologias to the emperor, public letters to the emperor, saying, why are you persecuting Christians? They're not atheists. They're not against you. In fact, they'll be your greatest supporters. They're about love. They're about peace. You know what I mean? So this is all in the Apologia. And he tells us what Christians do. This is all public. He got martyred, by the way. They martyred him because speaking the truth in a public way is not that popular then and probably not now. So the pressure to state clearly what people meant by what they said and the false judgments that were condemned as undermining faith created a dynamic that kept clarifying the question and uncovering ambiguities. I mentioned some that are still there, homoousios, still ambiguous after all that effort, so not easy, and implicit contradictions, as well as defining terms with accepted meanings to give expression to the wonderful mystery of Jesus in his relationship to God and to us. But I hope you can see there's a real danger in it becoming like a game of chess, perhaps, or a game of mathematics, in which people are arguing two different sides and they're losing sight of Jesus while they argue. That's the big danger. Dogma developed as people attempted to express the symbolic heart statements of the New Testament, which we've spent 3 weeks looking at, in terms that answered the questions people were asking in their searching for clarity of meaning by defining error and pointing the way towards the truth. You can't define the truth, you can define error. Put a fence around it, and then you point the way to the truth. What they contemplated in Jesus required an expanding of the meaning of words such as prosopon, phusis, ousia, hypostasis, and ousia. in Greek, and they're the English words there, person, nature, substance, being. What do you mean by all these things? Philosophy was actually growing by this struggle to find meaning in Jesus. It is essential to grasp the questions they were attempting to answer. That's true of all theology. If you know what the church said in Vatican II, and you don't know what the argument was, and you don't know why they said it as distinct from something else which they didn't say, you don't understand what the council said. I mean, I guess it's the same in every field, but in theology it's absolutely essential. That's why you need theologians, to actually read the footnotes and read, no, that's not it, and Bishop got up and said that, therefore they changed that word to that word. That's, otherwise the words don't mean anything, yet people grab the words, quote them, pound them from pulpits with no understanding, and it does nothing but harm. You've got to see, what were they trying to say? What were the questions? It's essential also to grasp the fact that in attempting to find clear, finely chiseled philosophical words, they were attempting to speak of the same Jesus that we find in the simpler, more homely words of the New Testament. Now I'm quoting me, God help us, desperate. Now I cover this at great length in those pages of my book, Who is Jesus? This is a summary. The councils of the early church cannot be thought of as the last word on Jesus. They belong to their time. They necessarily suffer from the limitations of the horizon of thought within which they were conceived. It has to be like that. We are to reject what they rejected. Paul of Samosata, Eutyches, whatever else, Nestorius under some aspects. What they said wrongly, we have to say, no, they made a mistake there, that's wrong. We might have had good intentions, but it's wrong. We are to reject what the bishops of the world came to reject. But we mustn't forget that they were attempting to answer their questions with the limited tools at their disposal. They never claimed that theirs were the only answers. So they never claimed questions. Sorry, they weren't the only questions. So they never claimed that theirs were the only answers. What we're looking for are the false understandings that they rejected and the consistent thrust of their faith convictions that directed them in their quest for clarity. Oh, sorry, before you go there. We have to find for our time the words that will express the insights that they expressed in their way, and we have to find new insights to answer the new questions that we're asking today. Always faithful to the tradition. Repeating the past is not good enough, because the questions our children are asking are not the questions that the past tried to answer. Our answers will have to be consistent with them, but we've all got to do theology, and we've all got to explore, and we can't sit down and think we've got the truth locked in and just hang on to it. It's totally unfair, and it won't communicate, it'll die. Now, Cardinal Newman, great man, has this to say. And I think it's just as relevant today, and it's a danger for me, of course. I'm not excluding myself from any of this. And it's a danger for you, and I see the danger in many places today too. Newman, writing back in 1880 or something, earlier, 1870 or 60, speaks of, quote, timid and narrow-minded people who were unwilling to receive the truth in that depth and fullness in which Scripture reveals it, and who thought that orthodoxy consisted in being at all times careful to comprehend in one phrase or formula the whole of what is believed in any article of faith. The book he's writing is Arians in the 4th century, a book that he wrote to show that Anglicanism was the centre, the media, the via media between Catholicism on the one hand and Protestantism on the other. So he went back and studied at great length the period I've taken you through in one morning, And the more he studied it, the more he studied it, I'm not saying everyone has to do this, but the more he studied it intellectually, he had to let everything go and join the Catholic Church. He had to leave he was the Anglican chaplain at Oxford University, he had to leave his friends, a lot of people misunderstood him. He had to go into a church which was English in the really old families, right from the Reformation, that had remained faithful, but basically it was Irish too, Liverpool, you know. And he went over to Ireland, and he's English, and that can't be easy. So he gave everything up, as I have to give everything up, and you have to give everything up for the truth. You can't hold on to something. Now, that's how he saw it. It just convinced him that intellectually he had to admit that Anglicanism was actually not at the centre of the Christian journey. Anyway. In a sermon on the Trinity, Newman says, and I'm not saying any of that against any Anglicans, you know that. Too many beautiful friends that are. But that's where he took, and I think all I'm really trying to say is that if any of us find the truth, we have to embrace it. In the Sermon on the Trinity, Newman says, "May we never speak on subjects like this without awe. May we never dispute without charity. May we never inquire without a careful endeavour with God's aid to sanctify our knowledge and to impress it on our hearts as well as store it in our understanding." Isn't that beautiful? And that applies to the whole of church teaching. Arguing about dogma is the silliest thing to do in the world. If someone wants to know what you think, say it simply, because you may enlighten them, and see what they think. They may enlighten you. As long as people say the kids today are, you know, really good at asking questions, and I think they might be. I ask a further thing, I say, do they want to hear the answer? They may. I'm not saying they don't. But there's no point of asking a question if you don't want to hear the answer or want to discover the truth with the person you're asking. Here's the opening address of the dear Pope John XXIII, given on October the 11th, 1962, at the Council, the opening of the Council of the Vatican. He said, "Christians and Catholics of apostolic spirit all the world over expect," he's talking to the cardinals and bishops, etc., "expect a leap forward in doctrinal penetration and the formation of consciences in ever greater fidelity to authentic teaching," brackets, not just what people call tradition, which means what grandma told me. That may have been a bit askew. Tradition has to take us right back to Jesus. And that's what the beauty of the Vatican Council was, liturgically and every way. It actually, Europe was kind of a bit in an ice age, theologically, for a long time. Pretty fixed, because people's lives were fixed and all that. And you know about the Black Death, and you know about a lot of European. So it's beautiful what's going on, but it's quite limited. So here you've got real tradition. But this authentic teaching has to be studied and expounded in the light of the research methods and the literary formulations of modern thought. We've got stuff we can use today they never had before. Use it. Linguistic studies, libraries, etc. And knowledge of the ancient world and so on. For the substance of the ancient deposit of faith is one thing. The way it is presented is another. And it is to this latter. The Vatican Council never declared anything to be heresy. There are no dogmas in it. There are no infallible statements in it. It wasn't about that. It was a church wanting to communicate to the modern world. Okay. The substance of the ancient deposit of faith is one thing. The way it's presented is another. And it is to this latter that careful and, where necessary, patient consideration must be given. Everything being measured according to the requirements of a teaching authority that is predominantly pastoral in character. The shepherd wanting to embrace the world and draw people to the truth and attract them to it, not excommunicate these and excommunicate those and fight over this and do what was going on at the Council of Ephesus, or just before the Council of Ephesus, back in 300 and in the early 4th century. That should be the conclusion am I allowed... I want to read to you something. I just gave a talk on Catholicism in the postmodern world. It's a long talk. I'm going to read the first two paragraphs only, even though I've gone over time, because I actually think it's quite relevant to today, and then I'll leave you, if I may. This is all in the public medium now, but I'll just... So I was asked to give two talks to our MSC parishes and, you know, priests and whatever, people that came, and 2 weeks ago, was it May the 2nd, whatever that was. And this is how I began, and I'll just say the two first paragraphs. The significance of Vatican II was that it forced into the open a reimagining of Catholicism that was the fruit of many years of pastoral praxis and biblical, liturgical, and theological investigation into the founts of our tradition. This had been happening here and there, but prior to the Council, it was easily missed and bypassed. We didn't basically know about it. In the Catholic world in which all of us grew up, Catholicism, in the Roman Rite, was thought of as all-encompassing. We thought it provided a complete belief system that answered all our questions. I thought this, maybe you didn't, but I wasn't the only one. It set the direction of our lives. Fidelity to the faith of our fathers was the basic commitment that would guide us through life to its goal. It gave us an ideal that we thought of as worth striving for. It provided a personal and social environment that was partly defined as not Protestant, not Orthodox, and not non-Catholic. We were educated and encouraged to live our life within the institutional frameworks that were imagined as fixed and settled. Many of us learned to love well within this institution, and our confidence in it was constantly strengthened by the valuable life experience that reinforced our confidence. This security could not survive the diversity of life experiences opened up by modern travel, by the information explosion, by awareness of the complexity of the world, and the real values found outside the system within which we'd grown up. We saw the world, I've forgotten the exact date, but you remember, from outer space as one globe. No one before us had ever seen that, this little lovely green planet that we saw from the exploring probe. To change the image, the river we were in, the Catholic River, Catholic schools, Catholic CYO, Catholic tennis courts, Catholic convents, Catholic priests, and you knew they were priests because of the way they dressed. You didn't have to kind of, it wasn't obscure. Nuns looked like nuns, and so on and so on and so on. And marriages that stuck together, whatever happened, might have been very ugly at times, but divorce wasn't known, you know what I mean? That's our world. The river we were in reached the sea. Ever been in a river when it reached the sea? And suddenly the flow is coming in a different direction. And your barge can't cope with the tsunamis, with the waves coming this way. You've been going 2,000 years down a river. And it's been very good. It's brought us to this place. But rivers are meant to come to the sea, and that's what happened. We came to know that people very different from us found meaning and a beautiful life in ways that were foreign to us. Who hasn't heard of Mahatma Gandhi? Who hasn't heard of maybe Mandela in more recent times? Who hasn't heard of the founder of the Baha'i religion? I mean, these are just extraordinarily beautiful people, and they're everywhere. And like it was a bit of a... They're not Catholics. Do you get me? We wanted to discover what it is that they saw. If some of us prefer to put our head in the sand and pretend that nothing has changed, our children won't have it. Their search for meaning can't be locked into any system, however rich, however graced, and they don't respect us for opting for a vision that they see as narrow. And I go on and on and on. What the church argued about in those early centuries is as vital today as it ever was then. We're in what they call the postmodern world. We have to find ways of embracing the world, and that's a real Catholic thing to do. And we have to find a way of being faithful to what we've seen, but recognize that the parameters within which we saw it were too small. That's all. And people who aren't in that too small world that I was brought up in, beautiful as it was, I don't regret it, and that was my life. And it's brought me to where I am, so I've got no regrets at all about it. But it ain't the world our children are in. It's just not it. So their questions are different, and they're missing so much beautiful stuff because we keep repeating the words that make sense to us when we were 14. And we're wondering why they're not listening. They're asking different questions. I haven't got kids, and I sometimes wonder, you know, there we are, so you know how little I know about it. But it's a bit, and not only kids, adults too. We're in a world that's asking different questions. Let's enrich it with what we really know, but it has to be humble, it has to be all-encompassing, and if the Catholic Church, I'm not speaking only of the Catholic Church, but if we're going to dare to call ourselves Catholic, which means all-embracing, we better bloody be all-embracing. We can't be a sect, and we can't follow leaders in the Church, as the leaders we've seen enough in the leaders of the, I'm not talking about the Pope or anything, I'm talking about just generally of leaders in the Church, who actually want a strong 1950s Hail St. Patrick church. Dead, gone, finished, sorry, we're past it. There's truth there, beautiful truth. What are we doing here? But don't you think we've all got to work to get in, connect, and with real people, and our answers will have to be so big, so beautiful. I think it's the first time the Church has had the chance to be Catholic now. Mm-hmm. Really Catholic. Because we're in the sea, and all the rivers have come into the sea. Everybody's asking the spiritual questions. Everyone's looking for truth. And if we present, as some of the Christian world presents, a powerful, we can have a nuclear bomb, but you can't, vision to the world, well, we've lost all that part of the world. And if I was in that part of the world, do you think what I'd be thinking? We're saying, blow you lot. You've got it, why can't we have it? Because it's the only way to stop you bullying us. So that's where we are when I'm... But somehow our heart has to embrace the whole world, and Catholicism is absolutely capable of it, and Christianity is absolutely capable of it because of Jesus. And just look at him in the New Testament. There's a lot of arguments we've gone on with today and people struggling to find words. It's important, and they did it, and okay, they've done it. We've got to do it again. But our words, I think that's why... Scripture has come on so wonderfully. I don't mean fundamentalism, you know what I don't mean that, because that's not Scripture. But why Scripture was the key renovator or re-enlivener of the Vatican Council and the Church since is precisely because Scripture is universal language. It's the language of the heart, it's the language of metaphor, it's the language of mystery, it's the language of imagery and symbol that speaks to anybody. If we keep it that way. So on the one hand, we've got to just tell fundamentalists, for God's sake, do some study. Stop all this ruining of Scripture for us. Don't let them near it. It's like going into the Louvre, bloody, what do you call it, art gallery, and saying they're all photos. So, well, I've known your photo, and walking out. I mean, you've missed the whole point of it, really. So we've got to fight that, really. It's a tough journey, but we've got to just not... Because there's an insecurity that's refusing to connect. On the other hand, we have to fight any kind of sense that what we might have had an assumption I had when I was a child that we were kind of right and Protestants were wrong, you know what I mean? And that's why I go on to say in that talk, just about what I said in the talk, but one of the great differences is in ecumenism. That's really so different now to what it was when I was young. When I was young, ecumenism meant and you had to become a Catholic, like leave what you are and join us. That was kind of what I suppose as a young man I assumed. Paul VI, Vatican Council, talks about the reintegratio unitatis. Reintegratio. You don't have to know Latin to know what that means. Reintegration. It admits that the Church is breaking, and this goes right back to the Orthodox Church at Constantinople, and now to the wonderful movements of the Protestant Church in Europe, thank God for them, that we all lost. We all broke. The whole family split up. You know, we're all suffering. We're all hurting. We're all missing so much. We need each other to bring it all in together. But you don't change being what you are. You don't stop being an Anglican and becoming a Catholic. You bring that into the universal church. And our Catholic thing is all about that, universal. We don't want you to change. We want you to give us what you've got, and we'll offer you what we've got, to be in communion. And unless Christianity does that, it keeps presenting this bizarre picture to the non-Christian world that makes it so unattractive. Mm. And we've been through enough wars in the last century, didn't we, without continuing it and bullying half the rest of the world? And I think I've talked well beyond my time, so God bless you.